You are listening to the Mob Files Podcast, a podcast about the history of the Italian-American Mafia and other influential organized crime groups in North America. If you enjoy today's episode, be sure to subscribe or follow. New episodes come out on Thursday evenings. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Mob Files. I'm your host, Brian McCoy. Our subject today is Las Vegas, specifically the city's deep connection to the Mafia. We're going to discuss the origins of the Mafia's interest in the city and explore how the Mafia is largely responsible for its early success. We will then go on to discuss the later involvement of Midwest mob families, namely Chicago, Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Cleveland. This portion will be focused in on the skimming operations set up by those families. We have a lot to discuss, so let's dive in. When people think of Las Vegas today, it seems like a match made in heaven for the Mafia. The city certainly did become a perfect match for the mob, but this kind of cuts both ways. The Mafia really helped to drive development and the economy in the city of Las Vegas. So just starting with a little bit of brief history about the city itself. Las Vegas was founded on May 15, 1905. In 1911, voters decided to officially incorporate the city by a total of 168 in favor and 57 opposed. Alright, fast forwarding a couple of decades now, two events in 1931 helped set Vegas on its path to becoming what it is today. Okay, number one, Nevada made it much easier for people to come there and get a divorce. Specifically, they made it so people could come into the state and after only 6 weeks be declared residents for purposes of getting a divorce. And number two, the state issued its first gaming license. I really probably should have said three things here because number three, construction started on the Hoover Dam, which provided a huge population increase for the city. This was very impactful due to the overall dreadful state of the U.S. economy at that point. It provided a bump for Las Vegas from all those new people coming in. Alright, moving ahead to the 1940s. So this is when casinos started to pop up along the Strip. In 1941, the El Rancho Hotel and Casino opened on the Strip. In 1942, Last Frontier opened. The Flamingo opened in 1946, and the Thunderbird in 1948. Vegas was really starting to boom at this point. You'll notice I haven't mentioned the mob yet, but this is probably a good point to go ahead and bring that into the conversation. There is a hotel and casino that also opened up in the 40s that I didn't mention above, the El Cortez. This joint opened up on November 7th, 1941. At first, some people didn't think the El Cortez would succeed because it wasn't centrally located on the Strip like those other casinos were. So why was this hotel and casino so important? Well, because it was one of the first targets of the Mafia's interest in Las Vegas. So now we're ready to dive into the mob in Las Vegas, and there were really two key players early on, which interestingly enough, neither of which were Italians. The first is Bugsy Siegel, and the second is Meyer Lansky. It's probably not fair to say only two key players, though. Gus Greenbaum and Mose Edway both worked for Lansky and were also instrumental in the early days as well. We'll start first here with a little bit of discussion about Meyer Lansky. I talked about him briefly in the Lucky Luciano episode. They were lifelong friends and associates. Lansky, as I said, wasn't Italian, but he is one of the most important organized crime figures in American history. He made his money in gambling. A lot of this money was made in Cuba, but a good chunk came from Vegas as well. Alright, moving on to Bugsy Siegel. Siegel, like Lansky, wasn't Italian. They were both Jewish. But, like Lansky, he became a powerful criminal. Siegel was childhood friends with Lansky, and they would go on to work together on many occasions. They formed a crime group known as the Bugs and Meyer Mob. Lansky and Siegel also both played an early role in the famous hit squad known as Murder Incorporated. This was a group of skilled hitmen who committed contract killings. They did a lot of the enforcement work for the Jewish mob in New York City as well as the various Italian-American mafia interests there. There's a lot more there to discuss on those two and their upbringings in early years, but I think that's enough background for now and we can get back to the mafia's ties to Las Vegas. But the important takeaways are that Siegel and Lansky were both very successful criminals and both had extensive ties to the Italian-American mafia. Siegel had been sent to Los Angeles in the 1930s to help establish gambling operations there. Now, part of this was due to Siegel being good at what he did, and the mob interest in New York knew they could trust him out there, but he was also somewhat of a troublemaker. I don't know if that's fair to say, but he ruffled some feathers, and so they thought it was best for him to get out of town. Now, Siegel had some troubles in California as well, similar to what had happened in New York, but he did help set up gambling operations there. Eventually, Siegel made his way to Las Vegas. He, very early on, saw the opportunity that the city presented. He recognized from the get-go that the direction the city was headed in would be beneficial for the mobs to be set up there, to have an interest there. So in 1945, Lansky and Siegel were part of a group that purchased the El Cortez Casino. By then, it was abundantly clear how good of an opportunity Vegas presented for organized crime. There were, of course, the legitimate aspects of this business, making money from gambling. It's not like there wasn't legitimate money to be made. But then also the not-so-legitimate aspects, which, you know, could include taking control of the construction processes, to skim off the top and also to launder money. And then, of course, once the casinos were up and running, skimming off the top to pass on to the mob figures and back in New York. Lansky saw all of this, and he decided that he wanted a piece of the action from the ground floor on a place of his own. And so he started working on the Flamingo Hotel and Casino project. The vision for the Flamingo was to be a very high-end resort and casino that would draw in the high rollers, not just from Vegas, but also from New York, and probably more so the high rollers in Los Angeles. Siegel was tasked with overseeing the process and also to run the place once it opened. This made a lot of sense. He was well trusted and he had a lot of those connections with the rich people in Los Angeles. But there were problems from the very beginning with this project. For one thing, the costs associated with it were astronomical. The casino's all-in cost ended up being more than $6 million, which is more than $60 million in today's money. And the troubles continued after the casino opened. The Flamingo had a soft opening in December 1946, but the hotel part was not finished, so the casino, the tables, the gaming area was ready for people to come in, but the lodging, the actual rooms themselves were not finished. And the casino started losing money almost immediately. Things got so bad that the casino was shut down in just about a month's time in January 1947. The troubles at the Flamingo actually became a very hot topic for the mob leaders back in New York City and throughout the country. As I have mentioned in other episodes, a meeting of major mob players was held in Havana, Cuba in December 1946. It was held there to accommodate Lucky Luciano, who had been deported to Sicily, and so he was able to make his way to Cuba, and where he could actually meet and still have some sway and influence over crime in the United States. What I have not gone into details on in regard to that meeting is the discussion of Bugsy Siegel. The mobsters were upset at the construction problems and inflated cost of the Flamingo project, and they also suspected that Siegel was stealing from them. Now, I have read a couple different things about the outcome of the meeting when it comes to Siegel. I have read that the mobster decided right there and then to put a contract on him, but I have also read that Lansky was able to convince him to give Siegel a little bit more time to try to turn things around. It didn't really end up mattering, though, because based on the events that followed, I think, personally, that the mobsters had made their decision. They had made up their minds. I'm not sure Siegel actually could have done anything to get them to change their minds and to save himself. My reasoning for that is based on the fact that after the casino reopened in March, things did improve. I mean, not greatly, but the casino finally started to turn a profit, and it looked like things were, back on the right track, headed in the right direction. But a few months later, Siegel was sitting in his girlfriend's house in Beverly Hills when a gunman opened fire through the window. Siegel was hit multiple times and killed instantly. To be fair, there are theories out there other than the commission ordering the hit on Siegel. He had a fair share of enemies, so those are somewhat plausible, but the timing is hard to ignore. They were upset about his work on the Flamingo, and he was killed a short time later. Most Edmund and other Lansky associates took over the Flamingo immediately after Siegel's death, and they did continue it on its profitable track and made it into a highly successful business for the mob. Okay, so moving on to the 1950s here. In the 50s, a number of mafia-controlled casinos opened up and started to be successful. This includes the Sands, the Dunes, the Riviera, the Tropicana, and the Stardust. The government obviously took notice of the mob's rise in Vegas, and they started to look into it. This charge was led by Senator Estes Kefauver from Tennessee. Kefauver, as you have probably noticed throughout my episodes, his name comes up a lot, and he was on a crusade against the mob, against organized crime in America. He was determined to expose their control and influence wherever he could. He held a number of hearings, and his committee actually held a hearing in Vegas in November 1950. The senator was successful in showing that the mob was involved in gambling in Las Vegas, but he sure as shit didn't slow it down much. People really didn't seem to care. They were there to gamble. I mean, what, were they just going to stop gambling just because they were worried about where the money that they had already lost might be going? No, that wasn't going to happen. And so the show went on. Okay, so now moving on to talking about some of these hotels and casinos in a little bit more detail. I'll start with the Tropicana Hotel. And now, just to be clear, there's going to be two parts of this episode that focus in on the Tropicana. So the first part is going to be kind of how it got started and how the mafia was involved with that. And then the later part comes around 20 years later when the Midwest mafia families, including Chicago and Kansas City, set up skimming operations there. So we'll start with the origins first. So in 1957, the Tropicana Hotel and Casino opened. The effort to open the casino was led by Philip Castell. Castell was experienced at running these type of operations, but more importantly, he was very close with Frank Costello, who of course was a very influential gangster and mob boss in New York City. It was not well known publicly that Costello and the mob were the real financial force behind the casino, and the way that the public actually found out about this, became aware of the connection, is a crazy story. There was an attempted hit on Costello in 1957. A gunman had followed him into his apartment building in Manhattan and shot him in the head. Now, luckily for Costello, the bullet actually pretty much just grazed him, just hit the flesh on his head, and he was largely unharmed. But when the police were searching through his clothes, they found a handwritten note which specifically mentioned casino winnings on April 26, 1957. It wasn't immediately clear what casino the note was referring to, but investigators were able to determine through a process of looking at the books of casinos and comparing it with the numbers on the note that the note was referring to the Tropicana, which had opened just a short time before. The note showed that in the very least, the mob had a significant interest in that casino. And like I said, this won't be the last we hear about the Tropicana. Las Vegas has been in the news a lot here lately, and it's mainly about how it's booming. Sports franchises are being moved there or opening up there, and it is largely controlled by corporate America. So like I mentioned, the government had been hell-bent on pushing the mob out of Vegas by prosecuting them, but corporate America was more successful actually at doing so, and they did so by speaking the mob's language, money. This occurred in the late 60s when corporate America started to make its presence felt in Las Vegas. Now, the big player in this was Howard Hughes, who was an aging billionaire who had made his fortune in film and aviation. And he started to buy up mob-controlled casinos. Now, a lot of the casinos were willing to sell because it meant a huge profit, but the mob wasn't going to go away that easily. The Midwest mob families, including the Chicago outfit, and like I said, Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Cleveland, would help the mob reestablish itself there. Alright, so turning now to the involvement of the Midwest mob families in Las Vegas. And again, we're talking about Chicago, Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Kansas City. The mobsters I have discussed so far have all been connected with New York City. But at some point, Chicago came onto the scene in Vegas and they never looked back. They became the dominating force there. It later came out that the other Midwest mob families were also heavily involved with the skimming operations. I'm going to focus on two casinos where these Midwest mob families were heavily involved, the Stardust and the Tropicana. We'll start here with the Stardust. The skimming operations at the Stardust are the inspiration for the movie Casino. The mob became involved with the Stardust through Alan Glick. Glick was a real estate investor from California. He became intertwined with the mob when he accepted huge loans from the Teamsters Pension Fund in an effort to buy up some casinos in Vegas. He used one of these loans to buy the Stardust in 1974 using his company, the Argent Corporation. Chicago, Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Cleveland controlled the Teamsters Union Pension Fund in the Midwest, so Glick was now indebted to them. He was basically the front man for their skimming operations at the casinos. This is where another major player in all of this comes in. Frank Lefty Rosenthal. Rosenthal is played by Robert De Niro in the movie. They changed the name to Sam Rothstein, but it's based on Rosenthal. The real Rosenthal was born in Chicago in 1929. His specialty was in bookmaking and odds making. He ran a huge gambling operation for the outfit in Chicago. So naturally, when they needed someone to run the day-to-day operations of the casinos and to run the skimming operations that they had an interest in, Rosenthal was the obvious choice. He led operations at multiple casinos in Vegas, including the Stardust. Rosenthal was very good at his job. He was able to filter a lot of the money back to Chicago and then down the line to the other Midwest mob families. One of the reasons he was so successful, specifically at the Stardust, was that he created the sports book there. He'd been a great odds maker back in Chicago, so he decided to apply these talents in Las Vegas and to help everyone make a little bit more money. Eventually, the feds became suspicious and started paying a lot more attention to what was happening at the Stardust. They built up their case, and in 1983, 15 people were indicted for charges related to the skim at the Stardust and at the Fremont. High-ranking figures from Chicago, Kansas City, and Milwaukee were among those indicted. Cleveland was added to this list a little later on. And these were some big names we're talking about here. The Savella brothers in Kansas City, Joseph Iupa, who was the boss of the Chicago outfit, and Milwaukee boss Frank Balestrieri. Investigators were able to track around $2 million that had been skimmed. The real number may have been higher than that, but that's what they were able to determine. The trial took place in 1985 in Kansas City. Now, federal prosecutors were able to flip a lot of important people to testify in the case. One of these was Alan Glick. He discussed the process of getting the loans from the Teamsters Pension Fund. Roy Lee Williams, who was a trustee of the pension fund, also testified and admitted to being controlled by Nick Savella in Kansas City. Williams stated that he was paid $1,500 a month for helping to steer loans where Savella wanted them to go. In terms of the financial success of the skimming operation, Angelo Leonardo, who was a member of the Cleveland mob before he flipped, was able to fill in the jury. He testified that each of the four families involved, again, Kansas City, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Chicago, were pulling in between $40,000 and $100,000 a month from the Stardust. So clearly, this was an extremely profitable operation. The prosecution had a great case, and some of the mobsters decided to plead out instead of rolling the dice by facing a jury. Balestrieri did this and was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Carl Tuffy DeLuna, who was the underboss in Kansas City at the time of the skim, also pleaded guilty, and so did Carl Savella, also from Kansas City. The defendants who elected to go forward with the jury trial didn't fare any better. All five of them were found guilty. This includes Iupa, as well as his underboss and two other mobsters from Chicago, Joseph Lombardo and Angelo LaPietra. The last defendant who went to trial and was convicted was Milton Rockman of Cleveland. I did forget to mention one thing. Nick Savella, the longtime boss of the Kansas City family who was heavily involved in the skimming operations, died before the trial took place. So after all this came out, the casino was moved into the control of legitimate business people. The skim had been an enormous success for the mob for many years, but it ended up coming with huge consequences for those involved. Okay, moving on to the other casino that we're going to talk about, the Tropicana. The operation at the Tropicana was a separate skimming operation set up by the Kansas City family. The guys on the inside for Kansas City were Joe Augusto and Carl Thomas. Augusto worked as an entertainment director at the casino, and so he was able to help skim money from that part of the operation at various times. Thomas was a longtime member of the gambling establishment, if you will, in Las Vegas. He was the perfect person to run things at the casino. He had a clean record, and there was no reason for people to suspect anything nefarious on his part, so he was a great front man. Now, Chicago was still at the top of the food chain in Vegas at this time, so Nick Civella wasn't going behind their backs or anything. He wasn't trying to set this up without their knowledge. Chicago knew about it, he informed them about it, and he sent up a piece of the profits to make sure that everything ran smoothly. Authorities actually discovered the scheming operation at the Tropicana by accident. Law enforcement had bugged a mob hangout in Kansas City, the Villa Capri Pizzeria, in the late 70s in hopes of gaining information about the ongoing mob violence in the city. Instead, they got tipped off about the operation at the Tropicana. The authorities had also bugged a house used by the Civella family in North Kansas City. Now, the reason I say used by the Civella family is that the house was very close to Nick Civella's, but obviously they didn't want to talk at Civella's house because they figured that it had been bugged by authorities at some point, or at least worried about it being so. But the authorities had enough information to bug this other house as well. In November 1978, they captured a conversation between Carl Thomas, Joe Augusto, and top-level Civella figures at that house. That includes Nick Civella, who was the boss, his brother Carl Civella, and Carl Tuffy DeLuna. Now, as I said, Thomas was the inside guy at the casino. He was the one who knew specifically how the skimming operations worked. So the conversation was a little bit of Thomas explaining how it worked to the mobsters, but the driver behind the conversation, the reason Civella wanted the meeting, was because he thought someone, or multiple someones, were stealing from him. Inside guys were stealing from him. He wanted to know if Thomas thought that this was occurring as well. Thomas basically told Civella, you know, hey, these are my guys, they're not stealing from you. But he also did admit that it would almost be impossible to tell if they actually were. And so really, you just had to trust your guys and trust that they weren't fucking you. That wasn't good enough for Civella, and he ordered a suspension of the skimming operation at the Tropicana. He wanted there to be a break where Thomas could do a full investigation and audit and try to see what he could find. And as it turned out, Thomas wasn't able to find anything, and they were able to convince Civella to kick the skimming operation back into gear just a few months later. So obviously, these tapes gave the feds a great starting point for taking down the operation. Eventually, the Civellas, Thomas, and others were indicted in 1981 for their role in the skimming operation. Those who managed to avoid trouble from the investigation were rounded up just a few years later in the Stardust investigation that I talked about just a bit earlier. Again, these skimming operations had been enormously profitable for the mob, but they ended up landing a lot of them in prison. I talked earlier about how Las Vegas and the Mafia were sort of a match made in heaven, and of course that is true, but as you can tell, the mob kind of made its own luck in Vegas as well. They were the early driver of Las Vegas' success. They helped make it what it is today. From the early efforts of Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky to the skimming operations by the Midwest mob families, Las Vegas' history is filled with mob associations and activities. Thank you for listening to episode 12 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed, be sure to subscribe or follow, and please leave a review on your listening platform of choice. Thanks again, and have a great day.